Hey there, this is Laura Kanoy.
Shh.
What? I mean, what?
Loretta Allison here. We're having a secret drive.
Oh, so that means...
Shh.
Oh, got it. If you love the exchange, consider a small donation to the station that makes it.
Go to nhpr.org/support and chip in, and we'll send you some secret swag.
We're trying to keep things quiet, but we hope you'll make some noise for the exchange.
This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A huge crowd gathered at the Statehouse yesterday, but not for a vote or a hearing or even a protest. Instead, consensus reigned in an event kicking off a new public awareness campaign on mental health. Given the array of political leaders who attended, it was an unusual display of bipartisanship, with everyone agreeing that the stigma around mental illness must be lifted. Here's House Speaker Sean Jasper.
Right now in New Hampshire, nearly one in five adults has a diagnosable mental health condition. Yet too often, families, friends, coworkers don't reach out for assistance.
The campaign is called Change Direction, and it's focused on what it describes as the five signs of emotional suffering. New Hampshire is the first state to launch this effort. Today in The Exchange, the Five Signs campaign that kicked off yesterday and where it goes from here. Let's get you into our conversation. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests in studio. Dr. William Tari is with us. He's a psychiatrist with Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine, vice chair of clinical services for the Department of Psychiatry at Dartmouth Hitchcock. And Dr. Tari has also worked for many years with West Central Behavioral Health. That's a community-based organization serving Grafton and Sullivan counties. Dr. Tari, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Also with us, Barbara Van Dalen. She's a clinical psychologist and founder of Change Direction. That's the national campaign that I just mentioned, promoting awareness of the signs of mental illness. And Dr. Van Dalen, it's good to meet you too. Thank you for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Also with us, Justice John Broderick. He's co-chair of Change Direction NH. He's also former dean of the UNH School of Law and former chief justice of the New Hampshire Supreme Court. And Justice Broderick, it's always nice to see you. Welcome back.
Great to be here, Laura.
Well, and I want to start with you, Justice Broderick. You have come out on this issue because of your personal connection. You said yesterday you failed your own son because you didn't know these signs of mental illness. What didn't you know, Justice Broderick?
Well, at the time, Barbara, when my son, Laura, when my son was 13 years old, I know now, and he knows now, that he had the onset of mental illness. In his case, he was really withdrawing from us and his friends, but he was an artist. He's actually quite a talented artist. And so we said, well, artists are different. They march to the beat of a different drummer. And so he became more private, not to the point where we didn't see him or he didn't have friends, but he spent more time in his room, for example, drawing, than I think now would be helpful and healthy. As his mental illness evolved, he became very socially anxious. He had real anxiety. For example, when he graduated from the eighth grade, we were pretty proud of that. He had gone to St. Joseph Junior High School. And so we were excited about the graduation, and he didn't want to go to his own graduation.
Oh, wow.
And we thought, you know, that's not the way it should be, but I didn't think he must have social anxiety. I'm not sure back then I even knew that social anxiety existed, Laura. And as he aged, he started drinking. And when we finally saw that, it was pretty alarming. And so we did what I think most people would have done back then. We talked to the alcohol people, and the word co-occurring was not used. The idea was he had an alcohol problem. We had to deal with that. As it turned out, that was a symptom of an underlying problem, which we didn't appreciate and no one told us about. So we acted on it in a one-dimensional way, which just made his underlying mental health problems worse. And so he drank more. And ultimately, when our family had this tragedy, which was very public in the state, we sat down with a psychiatrist who said to us, "Your son has all the life skills he needs, Judge Browder, to be very successful. He has serious depression, panic attacks, and anxiety that are almost off the charts." And he said, "Don't be too judgmental. If you had those problems and I offered you a six-pack of beer, you'd be drinking it. It wouldn't be a good decision," he said, "but it wasn't illogical." Since all of that happened, my son is so much better. But he was 13 and we were older. We were his parents. And I thought, I should have known more. I should have been smarter about it, and I wasn't. And now I'm much smarter about it, as is he. He's married. His wife is a remarkable person. She won an Emmy in New England for her work. And they have a beautiful 7-year-old daughter. And so when I could get involved in this campaign because of Dr. Vandala's genius, it was my story. Half of all mental illness comes on before age 14, two-thirds by age 24. So my son was 13, and I didn't know. And so I don't want people to make the mistakes I made, because the treatment options available these days are so much improved, and there's great success that's possible. So my son didn't have the benefit of a parent who knew what to look for or what to ask about. He does now, and he does himself. And so I hope this campaign will help families. And the last thing I want to say to your audience is every person who has mental illness has many people who love them. And so by helping the person with emotional suffering, you're helping their families and their friends and their colleagues. It's painful when it goes badly, and it doesn't need to.
It's a wide circle, is what you're
yes,
saying.
Yes, it's a very wide circle.
And I definitely want to bring our two other guests in. But Justice Broderick, I have to ask you this. You know, your son was a teenager. You know, you can't blame yourself too much for not knowing some of this with teenagers. I mean, they are withdrawn. They are moody. They do have these sort of, you know, weird responses to things that maybe they didn't have when they were kids and that an adult certainly wouldn't have. So it's hard to know.
Well, it's not easy to know, but let me give you an example in my son's case, which he never shared with us. He said to me, "Dad, I had no idea that I had any mental health problem. And why would I?" he said. But for example, if he had said to us, what he's now told us, "Dad, when I went to school, for me to walk down the hallway was so painful." He said, "My palms were sweaty for almost 7 years every day."
Wow.
He couldn't go to the mall. Now, that's not normal social awkwardness. But he didn't know to tell me that because he thought it was him and he would outgrow it. And that's part of the challenge. What I would love to see happen today, and I know then it would be working, is that parents like I am and was back then would know the basic signs, be able to say to their children at appropriate ages, "Look, just let mom and dad know if you have any of these feelings or experiences. Not a deficiency in you, but we need to talk about it. And there's plenty of medical assistance available. You may never feel that, or maybe just social angst that all kids have at a certain age." But in my son's case, it was very different. And had he told me that, Laura, I would have known that even back then, this isn't normal, and we should get him some help. So we need to talk about it.
Well, and that's what this whole campaign is about, knowing the five signs. And we'll definitely get into what those are and then what you do once you recognize them. But Dr. Vandala, do you have a personal experience with this issue as well?
I do. And I think it's safe to say that everyone has a connection to mental health challenges, either they themselves or someone they know. Yesterday in the chamber, I asked, as I regularly do when I speak, if there's anyone in this chamber who has not been touched by a mental health challenge, concern, or issue, raise your hand. Nobody did. No one ever does. In my case, my father was a veteran of World War II. He came home to Los Angeles. He was a first-generation American, and he wanted, as many veterans did, to take his young family and move to the rural part of California to sort of have that, you know, American dream. He didn't know by moving my mother, who was pregnant with me, moving her out of her support system in Los Angeles triggered a psychotic episode, and she was later diagnosed as schizophrenic. So my mother was then in rural California with my father, the veteran, with three little boys and a new baby. So for the next 8 years, my dad tried very hard to get her care and support. It wasn't available. There wasn't much available at all. And it wasn't understood. And people didn't talk about it. So eventually they split up, and she literally disappeared. I didn't see her for 43 years.
43 years. Wow.
And we just last year I found her again, because my sister-in-law and my brother agreed that we should try to find her. And we had found her once, and then she disappeared again, but I had never seen her. I hadn't seen her in 43 years. So now we know where she is. She's in a nursing home, and we're able to help take care of her in these last years of her life. So it was very difficult for my father. It was very difficult for our family, and there was no relief from the secrecy or the concerns that what would other people think? What would other kids think? And so we didn't talk about it, and we need to do things differently.
What's that secrecy all about? I know everybody talks about the stigma of mental illness and, you know, we need to get over that. But what is that about?
I think that we as a species, we as people, we're not comfortable being vulnerable for good reason. I mean, if we think back sort of in, you know, the caveman days, being vulnerable meant that you might get shoved out of the tribe. You might get eaten by a tiger. But that evolutionary part of us, we don't like to share what makes us feel weak or vulnerable or in any way different than others. But if we get over that initial reaction of, oh, I can't share this, what we find is that we share this with so many others. Yesterday at the event, this happens every time we have an event, every time we speak, and I know it happens with John as well. People then line up and they want to share their story with me. They want to tell me, this was my brother, this was my sister, and we all have a story.
You've worked with probably countless numbers of patients, Dr. Tari. What do they tell you, especially when you first meet them, about, you know, I feel funny being here. I should be able to, quote unquote, just get over this, you know, suck it up and figure it out. It's not like having a broken leg.
Well, by the time people see me, they tend to be suffering quite a bit. And people tend to be quite willing to talk about their lives. The work that I get to do is a real honor. People talk about things that are very, very important to them. And it's actually very interesting work, because when you're able to offer people science-supported services, people actually get better. I mean, it's amazing how ill some people are when I first meet them and then how well they do in their lives. So having access to services that have been shown to work is hugely important in this field.
Well, you have written, Dr. Tari, that, and I'm quoting you, the suffering from unmet need is extreme and intense. Give us a little more there, please.
Well, the most satisfying part about the work is actually being able to meet with people and offer services, because services that are well-studied make an enormous difference in people's lives. And we've known more. I've gotten to do this work in New Hampshire over 30 years now, and it's amazing how far we've come in knowing what's likely to work. Both medicines and psychosocial supports and therapies are much more effective than they were previously. But the hard part about the work being able to help people get access to services. People currently find that it's challenging to find the services that they need at the time that they need them. And as a clinical administrator, a lot of my job is trying to seek every way possible to make services more available to people and good services, because quality of service really does matter.
Well, and we should definitely talk about that, that once you know these five signs, what do you do? Are there services available and so forth? But since the campaign is focused on these five signs, let's just lay out what they are. And Dr. Van Dalen, what are the five signs? And by the way, we've got them up on our website and so forth. There's lots of material out there, but go ahead.
So these five signs, so that your listeners understand, these are signs that we chose that really cut across conditions and situations and diagnoses. These are signs are not meant to diagnose anyone. They're meant to help people recognize emotional pain and suffering in themselves or someone they love. So these five signs are, the first one is personality change. So people will often say about someone who is struggling, they're not the way they used to be. They seem different. That's an indication that something is happening. We don't know what it is. We might not know from our own experience with them, but it's an indication that something is up. Second sign is agitation. That could reflect someone who is extremely angry, explosive, angry, raging, or someone like John's son, extremely anxious, agitated, not sleeping, pacing. The third sign is withdrawal. And this sign does not imply that everyone has the same kind of social support network. This is withdrawing from what is normal for you or someone you care about. So not everyone is outgoing and an extrovert, but everyone has their social network. And so if you see someone who used to be going to their kids' games or hanging out at lunch with friends, and now they're doing neither, and it's an indication that something may be going on. The next sign is caring for yourself, personal care. By this, we mean someone may start engaging in behavior that is self-destructive, drinking too much, driving too fast, not taking care of themselves physically when they used to really care about their appearance.
Combing your hair.
Exactly.
Or wearing, you know, reasonable clothes.
Exactly. And the last sign is hopelessness. When people feel bad, when they are hurting, when they feel pain, they often articulate it in ways that we may not recognize that's what that is. But if you tune into it, again, people will go back in their mind and say, oh, she said, you know, it doesn't matter if I'm here. My family might be better off without me. I don't add anything in life. People often will brush that off or say, oh, no, you know, blah, blah, blah. You're fine or we love you without really tuning into that's very serious what that person is communicating.
Why five signs, Barbara? Why not 10 or six? Or is there another one that you would add on here if it, you know, fit neatly onto a five signs card?
Well, the reason we chose these five is these are things that everyone can observe. There are more signs, and we can talk about other indications of different conditions. These five cut across, whether it's post-traumatic stress, depression, anxiety, substance abuse, traumatic brain injury, loss, grief. So we wanted to choose five signs that people could recognize. We also wanted it to be simple enough for people to remember. We have five fingers. It makes it kind of easy to remember the five.
Do you want to jump in, Justice Broderick?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on something that you asked earlier, which is why don't people come forward more readily? Why don't they talk about it more readily? And they don't talk about it more readily because they have been taught to be ashamed. And I know that because in the aftermath of my family's tragedy, which thankfully has turned our direction, but people would come up to me, Laura, I was still on the court. Every one of these people was a perfect stranger to me. And every one of those people would confide in me because they knew we were on that journey too, that their mother, their father, their sister, their brother, or themselves. And let me give you one story that's very recent. A woman who I met 2 or 3 weeks ago for 5 minutes as I was talking on this issue called me last week to confide in me, a person she had met for 5 minutes, about a family member's hospitalization for depression and anxiety. And I called her back the next day. I wasn't quite sure who she was. And she said, I was going to ask you to go visit my husband. He's hospitalized. And I said, actually, I would have gone to visit your husband. I don't know if I would have been very helpful, but I understand the pain you're in. And I said, maybe told his employer what's going on. I said, oh, no, I couldn't tell them. And I thought to myself, first of all, she reached out to me. This is a very competent woman, professional woman. She wasn't sharing that with friends or colleagues or extended family. She picked me basically out of the Yellow Pages. And I thought, I'm glad she called me, but I thought, how sad is that? And that's where we are as a society. So what Barbara's trying to do, which I just think is extraordinary, simple but extraordinary, is to change the culture so people feel free to talk.
We'll talk more about those efforts in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Change Direction, a new national initiative encouraging awareness of the five signs of mental illness. New Hampshire launched its statewide campaign at our statehouse yesterday. We're finding out more what these five signs are, how to recognize them, and then we'll talk about what you do if you do recognize them in a loved one or in yourself. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Just before the break, our guests were talking about the stigma associated with mental illness and how people still don't like to talk about it. A lot of people at the Statehouse shared stories like that yesterday. Here's a little bit from 1st Congressional District Congressman Frank Ginta explaining how the mental illness in his family affected him and the stigma surrounding it.
As a matter of fact, I remember a day when I was in a hearing at municipal, county, and government where somebody was testifying about those people. And that individual was referencing people who had mental health diagnoses. And I remember sitting there being angry and frustrated because for the last 20 years of my life, I have been the direct caregiver of a family member of mine who has a very unique and challenging mental health diagnosis. Our family has gone through years of personal challenge. We have tried to help others who have been in the same circumstance.
Again, that's 1st Congressional District Congressman Frank Ginta, among many people sharing their stories of their family's struggles with mental illness at the Statehouse yesterday. 1-800-892-6477, again, is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guests for the hour are Justice John Broderick. He's co-chair of this new campaign called Change Direction NH. He's also former dean of UNH School of Law and a former chief justice of the New Hampshire Supreme Court. Barbara Van Dalen is also here, a clinical psychologist and founder of Change Direction, the national campaign, along with William Tari, psychiatrist with Dartmouth-Geisel School of Medicine, and a longtime leader in behavioral health, including many years at West Central Behavioral Health. That's a community-based organization serving Grafton and Sullivan counties. And all of you, let's go to our listeners now. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. And in Nottingham, Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. A couple of things that strike me. One, I would add to the big five just the concept of isolation. When they touched on it before, when someone stops eating with you or stops hanging around, that to me is a major sign. But I want to get to the reason I called is that one of the problems is that people who have mental illness do not look sick. Namely, if you have a broken leg or if you have a rash, people will say, go see a doctor. You got to get some help. And then he will give you sympathy. If you often have a mental illness, you have an internal battle, but you look just fine to the rest of the world. And the last point I want to make is that people who have successfully gotten treatment often don't talk about it because they've been cured and they don't want to let anyone know about it. So you don't hear the successes. If someone had a successful knee replacement, they should let everyone in the world know about it.
You're so right, Steve. And I have talked to people who had successful knee replacements and they've told everybody, hey, look at my knee and I'm hiking the 4,000 footers this weekend. I'd love your thoughts, Dr. Tari. You first, please.
Well, it's absolutely right. These are great observations. In every single room that you sit in, there's people that have lived themselves with mental illness or have a close family member who's lived with the illness. And often people don't talk about it. If they did talk about it and if they talked about their efforts to get care, there'd be more people advocating for care and more people hopeful about what care can provide. I mean, one of the challenges with stigma is that people who suffer from these illnesses, and by the way, no one asks to have a mental illness. You don't ask to have a mental illness any more than you ask to have cancer. It's not something people ask for. But when people that suffer from these illnesses not only suffer from the illness, but then they suffer from how people treat them or how they feel their isolation that comes along with having the illness because of stigma. So stigma is keeps people alone and isolated. And bringing people together and to talk about their experiences can be very powerful.
I wonder if part of the stigma and not wanting to talk about it, Dr. Tari, and I want to hear from everybody, is people not wanting to jeopardize their standing in the community and, quite frankly, their jobs. If you come out with, you know, your mental illness struggles, you might be afraid that nobody would hire you.
Well, I think it has to do generally with how people's fears about how they'll be treated. We do know that stigma can change. When I was small, people didn't talk about having cancer, and the fact is that has changed significantly over time. And we have other examples of stigmatized conditions that have changed in our lifetime. I think, you know, one example is people were often didn't talk about being gay, 15, 20 years ago, and people are much more open about that, and it's much less stigmatized than in the past. So I believe that campaigns like this campaign can make a huge difference in people being more open, and that in itself can reduce suffering.
Do you want to jump in?
I would. There are a few things, and Steve made great observations, every single one of the things that he said. I want to, in a way, sort of pause for a moment and frame this. We often think, and we heard Congressman Ginta say, you know, those people, which was very painful. I used to feel that as well. I didn't talk about my mother being schizophrenic. And when people talked about people with mental illness, it would make me, you know, flinch inside. We often think about those people as those people who have mental illness. In a way, that removes some responsibility and also some opportunity to relate to and resonate with people, because we may not all have a diagnosable mental illness, but it's difficult to imagine anyone who has not experienced emotional suffering and mental health challenges, whether it's the stress and anxiety when you're going through a job change, whether it's the loss and pain. Talk to somebody who's lost a loved one. They don't have a mental illness, but they are suffering terribly, and they may, in fact, experience and express symptoms, signs. They're not sleeping. They're not eating. And if that goes on too long, it may turn into a condition that would need to be treated, to be addressed. So I want to make that point, because if we continue to see only mental illness as something that we need to talk about, it then makes that a very small group, as opposed to if we need to talk about emotional well-being, that means all of us. And these five signs apply to all of us.
Okay, and I'm glad you raised that, because I wanted to ask you, the campaign talks about the five signs of emotional suffering, not mental illness. So is that why you're doing it? Because if, in one sense, Dr. Van Dralen, if you want to destigmatize mental illness, emotional suffering doesn't sound as bad as mental illness, as serious as something that needs treatment, diagnosis, immediate help.
Well, that's a great comment, Laura. And I think John will share with us this notion of the continuum of human condition. The human condition is on a continuum. There were times in my own life, because of either my brother died when I was 15, that was a very painful, difficult time. If anyone had stepped in and looked at me at that point in my life, would I have looked like I was depressed? Absolutely. Was I depressed?
You would have exhibited these signs.
Absolutely.
Sure.
And so we all are on that continuum. For some of us, because of an external event, our service members, our warriors, the trauma they experience in war might cause post-traumatic stress. Would they have experienced that? Would they have developed that condition had they not been in that situation, or a woman who's raped? No. So is it the cause, a genetic predisposition to a mental illness? In that case, no. Are they suffering emotionally? Are they showing these signs? Are they in danger if no one steps in? Absolutely.
So calling it emotional suffering, the five signs of emotional suffering, that's very deliberate. And you're saying it's not a watering down.
No, it is not. Exactly. Someone who is psychotic is suffering emotionally. someone who is experiencing depression, is suffering emotionally, post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury. Where we want to start is for people to say, I see that this person is in emotional pain. I may not know why, but I want to reach out. I want to connect. I want to share my own experiences. As Steve said, I want to share my experiences of what has been helpful to me so that we open up the conversation and we move forward as an entire conversation, not just that one spot.
Let's take another call. This is Anne in Pembroke. Hi, Anne. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I guess I'd just like to hear what your panelists would say about the difficulty of what happened to me 35, 40 years ago at this point, which was I had something of a normal childhood. And then simultaneously, when I hit my teenagehood, which is like a syndrome in and of itself, my mom's mental illness kicked in. And she ended up dying when I was 15.
Wow, and, I'm sorry about that, Anne.
Yeah, and it was really hard. And I think, and at that point, because my body was going through all these changes, I was sort of rewired for, you know, this stressful situation. And I have the same genetic disposition that my mom had. So, you know, when you talk about these, you know, these changes of dressing differently or sleeping differently or something like that, I, you know, went through all these different changes in teenagehood, and my family was like, oh, she's just being a teenager. Whereas my brain, I really felt like my brain had completely shifted gears.
You know, this is such a good point, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, Justice Broderick, but especially with teenagers, and the tough part is a lot of the time it seems like mental illness does have its onset in those years, but people are a little bit crazy in their teenage years anyway, regardless of any emotional suffering or mental illness.
Well, as the call is correct, and as you are, having said that, however, it doesn't mean that we can't do a better job. We may not find everyone with emotional suffering and know why, but right now we are not talking about it. Let me give you an example which I think applies. I remember 1957, Lauren. I'm old enough. I was younger then. It was a better year. But in any event, in 1957, the only person that I recall using the word breast in public was Hugh Hefner of Playboy magazine. In 1957, in the kitchen of our home, I asked my mother about my best friend's mother. She was not well. And my mother, just the two of us, leaned towards me and whispered the word cancer, because if you said that loud, you might contract it. Some years later, somebody put breast and cancer together, found a color, and have changed outcomes for thousands and thousands of women. Nothing comparable has happened with emotional suffering. We all need to grow up. We all need to understand that it's not okay to have those problems, but it's okay to have those problems. We have done that in every other area of medicine, to my knowledge. So there has to be some parity in terms of public discourse and disclosure. If we do that, we will find more people who have a more serious problem. But if we don't do it, we're in denial. It's not helpful.
Anne, thank you so much for the call. Dr. Tari?
Well, I think people generally don't appreciate how common psychiatric illnesses are. When 1 in 5 women has a major depression in their lifetime, 1 in 10 men, 1 in 100 people has bipolar illness, and 1 in 100 people has schizophrenia. Those are very common illnesses, and you know, they can be painful, sometimes disabling, and even sometimes deadly. You know, suicide is the second most common cause of death in New Hampshire for people between the age of 15 and 45, and about 3 people per week in the state die by suicide. So these are very common difficulties. And, you know, part of what I like about this campaign is just bringing it to people's attention so that we can, you know, actually turn into it seriously so that people, when they seek any kind of care, they go to their primary care doctor, can get help.
Can you just repeat those suicide numbers, please? Because there was a national headline around rising suicide numbers in the U.S. So just give us those again, please, Dr. Tari.
So for people between the age of 15 and 45, it's the second most common cause of death. In New Hampshire, more than 3 people a week die by suicide.
Real quick, Dr. Van Vrijlen.
I just wanted to say that in Anne's case, clearly no one knew to step in and ask her the questions to help differentiate. Was this just normal teenage? Of course, teenagers are expressing themselves. They're checking stuff out. They do odd and interesting things, but it's not because they are need to suffer emotionally. People think, oh, teenagers must go through this painful. That's not accurate. They go through changes. They go through all kinds of experimentation. But what Anne was describing, and I am so sad and sorry for her that no one noticed at 15. I lost my brother at 15. I know what kind of pain she was in. No one stepped in to talk to me. No one stepped in to talk to her.
And thank you again for calling in. And all of you, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Joining us now on the line is Ken Norton. He's executive director of the New Hampshire chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Ken Norton, always good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Good morning.
What went through your mind, Ken, as people yesterday, big crowd at the State House, celebrated the fact that New Hampshire is the first state to jump on this Change Direction, Learn the Five Signs campaign at a state level?
Well, I think a couple things. One is that, you know, we really were changing direction and elevating the conversation by the number of high-profile people in our state who got up and told their personal stories. But also that, you know, it's in many ways it's fitting that we are the first state to do this. New Hampshire, although our mental health system is struggling right now, has been known for its innovation. We were rated number one back in the 1990s. People came from all over the country to see our mental health system. But even now, there are many programs that have been developed in New Hampshire that are very innovative and are being replicated across the country. We have military liaisons embedded in our community mental health centers. We have a peer liaison that's part of the staff at New Hampshire Hospital. We have several suicide prevention programs that have been developed in New Hampshire that are on the National Best Practice Registry, the Gun Shop Project, working with gun shop owners around firearm sales. And there's a Life of an Athlete program for young people that's a suicide prevention program. All of these are programs that have been developed in New Hampshire that are really innovative and getting a lot of attention. So in some ways, it's fitting that we're the first state to unroll this.
Okay, and in other ways, Ken, and you know this way better than I do, New Hampshire is under this settlement agreement right now, trying to work through the steps, trying to buff up its mental health system after some big concerns about decline. So how does this campaign, Know the Five Signs, fit into that effort that you've been working on?
Well, I think that that part of that challenge relative to the settlement agreement is we are in substantial noncompliance, according to the expert reviewer's January report. That settlement agreement only applies to adults and not children. But I think that the whole point of this campaign is twofold, that it's we really need from a public health perspective, and I think advocates and family members have known this for a long time, is that we all need to be as well-versed in recognizing the signs of mental illness as we are for a heart attack. And, you know, I mean, if you ask the average person on the street, they can tell you what those signs are for a heart attack. So that's the first part. And then we need to use that to elevate and change the direction of the conversation. I mean, given the struggles that our mental health system is having, we collectively have not been effective at changing the conversation. And so hopefully events like this and the diverse number of people that were in that room yesterday, from law enforcement to providers to family members to people with mental illness themselves to legislators to, you know, to doctors, really does help elevate and change that conversation.
Well, Ken Norton, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Ken Norton, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And all of you, after a break, we'll sort of turn the corner. Okay, so you know the five signs, you recognize them, maybe you see them in a coworker, a friend, a loved one. What do you do? We'll also take more of your questions and comments, so join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how to recognize mental illness, emotional suffering, how to talk about it, and what to do about it, we're finding out about a national campaign that had its Granite State launch at the State House yesterday for a big crowd. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. The campaign is called Change Direction NH. It talks about knowing the five signs of emotional suffering. We've put them up on our website, by the way, if you want to take a look. It's nhpr.org/exchange. You can join us now with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Dr. Tarr, I did want to turn to you. We were starting to get there with Ken Norton just before the break. So let's say you recognize the five signs. Let's say you say, gee, my sibling has four out of these five. Then what do you do?
Well, first of all, talk to the person and learn a little bit about what they're going through and help them to be okay about talking and seeking help. There are a variety of places that people can seek help. The first step professionally would be to actually get a good evaluation. A conversation with someone who – with a professional can be really helpful in sorting out what kind of a thing is this and what's likely to be the most useful, and then to get help in turning towards whatever is likely to be most useful. There are a number of providers and ways of finding services in the state. Both there are private practitioners, there's emergency services, and there are the community mental health system, all of which are still extremely good in the state.
I've heard that there's a shortage of child psychiatrists in this state, especially a shortage of psychiatrists generally nationally, but especially for kids here in New Hampshire.
Well, there's definitely a shortage of psychiatrists nationally. People say that about 55% of psychiatrists are 55 years of age or older. So it's the oldest profession specialty in medicine right now.
Wow, that's interesting. So lots of people right on the edge of retiring.
Yep. And it's challenging to recruit psychiatrists. I think one of the exciting things that's happening in the field, though, is that psychiatrists are shifting what they do quite a bit so that they're supporting other professionals. So increasingly, the role of psychiatrists is to be supporting other professionals in primary care, for example, so that in our services, we have psychiatrists embedded in primary care who can provide consultation. What that means is that they can leverage their knowledge in helping the primary care doctors to do supporting them in the care so that the psychiatrist's knowledge can spread out and support many more people that will then touch the patients. And it also means that people can come into primary care and get a good evaluation for emotional suffering, such as we're talking about.
Wow. So that's tricky, though, right? Because, you know, you're the expert in terms of mental health. How much do you want to farm that out to somebody who's a general practitioner?
Well, there are a lot of general practitioners who are excellent in this regard to start with. And they most psychiatric care actually takes place in primary care. But having said that, the structure of primary care does not always lend itself to evaluations and care for mental illness. So,
well, they've got 20 minutes, boom, boom, you're in and out. So
it helps them a whole lot if you can add resources into the clinic, both help evaluation and then helping them with people that aren't getting better as expected. And those sort of services can leverage the skills of psychiatrists to a large degree. And it also is good for people because individuals want to come into their primary care and get help with whatever it is they're suffering with. I love this slogan that started in Great Britain, which is no health without mental health. There really is no way of being healthy if you are not addressing your mental health concerns along with your general medical concerns.
Sure. And if you're suffering emotionally, Dr. Vandrelli, you're not going to do the things that you need to do for physical health. Self-care is one of the five signs or lack thereof.
Well, absolutely. And we know that mental well-being and physical well-being are inextricably connected. Anyone who just stops for a moment and thinks about how you feel emotionally when you are really sick or when you're coming out after a surgery or when you've had an accident. Similarly, having those kinds of physical challenges, conditions can lead to depression, anxiety. So it is very important that our primary care docs and pediatricians understand these issues, work with mental health professionals. And I completely agree. There's a wonderful psychiatrist who works in Africa. And his statement that I love is mental health for all by involving all. There's so much more that we can do as people to support those who are suffering, who are hurting, that we haven't done. People often feel like your caller earlier, Steve, talked about isolation. People don't share. Therefore, they don't get the support, the caring, the compassion that in and of itself can be a really critical piece of healing.
Here's an email from someone who didn't give a name, and I definitely want all of you to respond to this because this person makes a really good point. He or she says, again, didn't give a name, I was actually at the Know the Five Signs event yesterday, and while I found it wonderful in terms of being an anti-stigma event, I was very troubled by the implication that if people just recognize the signs, there is help available. Everyone at the event yesterday is aware that there are people waiting right now in emergency rooms for a bed in a psychiatric hospital. This person says, in my own experience, I've had great trouble finding a psychiatrist, even though I have insurance and I am asking for help. I just called 22 mental health providers in my own area who use my insurance, and none of them are available. Wow. This person concludes by saying, I was very upset yesterday by the implication that if you ask for help, you can get it. I have found this to be deeply untrue, and I would appreciate it if the guests would reply to this. I want to thank this person for sending the email. This is a very important point. And Justice Broderick, you first, please.
Sure. I understand that frustration, but I want to make this point. The goal of this campaign, narrowly focused, is public knowledge and public information to begin discussions, to begin to change the culture. This campaign is not advocating for a specific solution, although hopefully as the discussions ensue, people who are doing that will feel empowered because there'll be more people coming forward. Our goal is not to make this into a political circumstance or an advocacy circumstance, although those are both important. The role of this group is to start the discussion, what people do with it, where they go with it. And I understand there are a lot of issues that people can address, but our goal is not to find a solution or to criticize what's on the ground, not our purpose, although others will and maybe others should. I don't think anyone yesterday, at least that wasn't my sense, that we were saying help is easy. I don't think it is easy here or elsewhere. But what we want people to do is to kind of get the discussion going. I believe, Laura, that with this campaign, it's like build it and they will come. I think if people start to feel it's okay to have a mental health problem and are more informed as to what it looks like, people will start to realize potentially that we don't have the infrastructure we need and actions will be taken. That's a political solution, which I think will be necessary. It's not the goal of this campaign in the state or nationally to advocate for more funding or different treatment modes. That's not what we're doing. All important.
Was it discussed, Justice Broderick, as you were looking at this and talking about launching it here in New Hampshire, was that angle discussed? Because we've got a couple people on Facebook and email saying, okay, great, talking about it, but nothing there for support or not enough there for support, as this person says.
I would say this. What's really important, Laura, there are a lot of people out there, some of them listening today, who would never tell you or me or anyone else, who would not be able to find the signs in their own family or circle of friends. Our goal is not to make life perfect. We can't do that. We're not funding mental health programs. We're not criticizing mental health programs, although there's plenty to be said in that arena. I honestly believe that if we focus too quickly on those who say, I can't get treatment today, although that's important, we are missing the purpose of the campaign, which is to take a much broader, longer-term view of what we're doing. If we change the culture through Barbara Van Dalen's genius here, in my view, the issues that everyone's focused on will then be addressed because the public will say, we can now talk about this and we need to fix it. But that's not what we're doing.
So that's the first step.
First step is to change the culture.
And we've seen in other situations. We've seen the power of culture change to make services available. All we need to do is think about the AIDS epidemic. We remember, those of us who are old enough, what that was like in the early years and the tragedies and the loss of life and the confusion and the anger. Completely different situation now for somebody who's diagnosed with AIDS. How did that happen? It happened in part because the AIDS quilt traveled around the country. People became aware. They felt compassion. They had understanding. And research money started pouring in and treatment programs. So as John said, our goal here is to elevate the conversation. And if and we have been asked many times, this is not the first time that I've sat in a station like this and people have said, well, now what do we do? There aren't resources. And what I've said is bring it on, because if the community then sees, oh, my gosh, here are not only the concerns and the challenges, but people are now sharing about what helped them, what worked for them. Things will change because the system will respond. It has to. If the system is acknowledging something differently, the system will change.
The AIDS example is interesting. So you're saying, again, in the shadows, stigma, no one's talking about it. Once people start talking, then the research, then the drugs, then the all those efforts follow.
Absolutely.
What do you think, Dr. Tarr?
Well, I completely agree. I think that the core issue is changing the culture. I think when the culture changes, if people talk about their own personal experiences, their family experiences, that rest will come. I do think right now, the situation is actually outrageous right now, honestly.
In terms of services available here in New Hampshire?
Yeah, and nationally, but here. If I develop colon cancer, I could call up and get care. If I had a heart attack, I could call up and get care. If I had a thyroid problem, I could call up and get care. If I develop a depression and I call up, it's highly likely that it would be challenging for me to find a provider who can care for me quickly. I think that if people and people live with these experiences alone, again, if the culture was different, I think there'd be a much greater outcry and outrage about the current situation and the services would be available.
Well, this person who emailed again says he or she just called 22 mental health providers who use my insurance and none of them are available. Kimberly sent us a Facebook comment who says Riverbend getting rid of psychiatrists and cuts in state mental health funding isn't helping the situation. Why aren't these obstacles being discussed? Kimberly, thank you for that comment. And Ken says, we need to stop treating all mental illness as one thing. He says, depression and anxiety do not make people into mass shooters, but we constantly hear about mental health treatment, he puts quotes around that, associated with criminals, which is a connection when I talk about my mental health treatment. Can you address that, Dr. Van Dralen? This is a salient issue in our culture right now.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, it is those sensationalized cases that get covered in the news, and we don't hear about the day-to-day challenges, struggles, recovery, the way people live with their mental health challenges every day. When I go in to talk to employers and they're concerned about hiring veterans, they're, oh, we don't want to hire veterans because of post-traumatic stress. And I will say what you heard earlier. Did you know that 1 in 5 Americans have a diagnosable mental health condition? Not veterans. Americans. Therefore, many, many folks that you have in your company right now are functioning. We function with many of these mental health conditions. And the other point I'd like to make that your emailer raised, one size doesn't fit all. It isn't just medication or therapy that can be helpful for people who have mental health challenges. We know from good data that things like meditation, yoga, engaging in service, peer-to-peer support, prayer, many things can help us maintain our emotional well-being, which is why the goal of this effort is to encourage all Americans, all folks in New Hampshire, pay attention to your emotional well-being and the well-being of those you love. We start there, and then we look at what's available. We look at maybe what's a non-traditional response. And again, the community will shift because people will be out talking about things that up to this point have been isolated in the dark secrets.
What do you think about this Facebook comment from Ken, Justice Broderick, you know, that people sometimes associate, especially nowadays when people are concerned about mass shootings, they associate mental illness with criminal violence?
Yeah, it's not fair. It's not that it doesn't happen, Laura, but if you associate mental illness with people going to theaters and randomly killing people, that's pretty alarming. it's at the far end. I agree with Dr. Vandell, and most of it's in the broad middle. And so it's valuable that people talk about it, but not if it's extrapolated to what mental illness is. One more thing I wanted to say, which I give my son credit for in helping me. He's been a great tutor to me on this, too. When I showed him the five signs.
Right. I wonder what he thought.
He said, Dad, if I'd seen that when I was 15, I would have said, my gosh, that's my problem. He said, the value of this campaign is not just so the rest of us are more informed, but since the mentally ill are the last to know it, he said to me, Dad, there's a difference between knowing you have the measles, because you know you can be treated or that you'll get better, and thinking you are the measles. And it so becomes who you are. And he said, I had no idea I had a mental health problem. And he told me that when he was in his 20s, he was watching a Red Sox game and there was a commercial on about a medicine called Paxil. And he said, I was listening to the description of why you might want to take this medicine. He said, I looked up and I said, my God, they're talking about me. He said, I realized at that moment that I had a mental health problem, not that I was the mental health problem. And so I think it's important to know that people like my son, although unique to me, is not unique. And the value of this campaign is so that sometimes those who are afflicted will realize they are afflicted, if not who they are.
That's a really key distinction, isn't it?
It really is.
And he put it beautifully.
He did. The other thing I'd say, when my son was released from his confinement here in New Hampshire.
He was in state prison while you were on the state Supreme Court. That's an unusual situation.
It was pretty tough, but he's an amazing person. He's the bravest person I know. And he said to me one day, he said, Dad, you're very popular over here today. I said, what did I do? He said, I don't know, but they think you're great. I said, they won't tomorrow. But when he was let out on parole, someone came up to us. They didn't know anything about our family circumstance, and they put a camera and a microphone in front of us. And they said, do you have any comment about what happened here, the parole? And I said, we're very happy my son's coming home. I said, you need to understand, my son is not a bad person. He's now good. He's always been a good person. He's now well. And those are very different things.
We could talk a lot longer, but we have to close it out here. I want to thank all three of you very much for being here. And Barbara Vandralen, it was really nice to meet you.
Thank you very much.
That's Barbara Vandralen. Again, she's a clinical psychologist, founder of Change Direction, a national campaign, as we heard, promoting these five signs of mental illness. And William Tari, it was nice to meet you, too. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Justice Broderick, it was good to see you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.